Book Show, a celebration of reading and writers. I'm Joe Donahue. At 23, after leaving graduate school to pursue her dreams of becoming a poet, Joanna Rakoff moved to New York City and took a job as assistant to the storied literary agent for J.D. Salinger. She was tasked with answering Salinger's voluminous mail. But as she read the letters, she was drawn into the emotional world of Salinger's fans and eventually abandoned the required template and began writing back. Her memoir of that time is called My Salinger Year. J.D. Salinger was a known recluse. Even though the rest of the world didn't hear from him, the agency Joanna worked for, and Joanna herself, did.
But I personally was an anomaly, and the year that I worked at the agency was an anomalous year. So when I took the job, my boss, on I think my third day of work, called me into her office and said, she had already given me a talk about, you know, we need to talk about Jerry. You cannot ever give out his phone number, et cetera. So this was the day before. And then the day after, this talk about, don't give out his phone number. People are going to call and ask for it. Don't ever give it to anyone. You know, you'll be fired. The next day, she called me into her office again and said, there's something I forgot to mention. People sometimes take this job thinking that they're going to become Salinger's friend. They think they're going to talk to him on the phone all the time. They think they're going to tell him about their stories, and he's going to say, oh, send me your stories, and I'll edit them for you, or whatever it is. And that's wrong. You're never going to hear from him. He doesn't call. If he does call, the receptionist will put him directly through to me. If by some crazy chance someone makes a mistake and he gets put through to your line, you say, Mr. Salinger, I will get my boss. You don't say anything more to him. Don't try to keep him on the phone. Don't try to make chit-chat with him. Don't ever call him yourself. So something might arise while I'm not here, and you might think that you can just call him and ask him his take on it. Maybe it will seem like an emergency. No, never, ever, 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 ever call him. Don't waste a minute of his time. But all of this is moot. You're never going to hear from him. You're never going to meet him. And then that day, he called. So this was this anomalous year because, these warnings, I know because I've met other assistants. I mean, as in people who held my job before and after me. And it was true. They really didn't hear from him. So it just so happened that the year that I worked there, he decided to publish a new book. Not a book that was consisted of new work, but
a New Yorker story.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. His last published New Yorker story.
Hapgood 16, 1924.
Hapworth, yes, exactly. Hapworth 16, yeah. Which is this 65-page short story. It took up a whole issue of the New Yorker. And largely considered his worst story, though it has its own followers. It has people who love it crazily. I've met some of them on my tour.
Your book made me go back to read it, actually.
And did you like it?
Not really, no. No, I thought you nailed it in the book, yes.
Yes. So he had been approached by a small publisher about turning the story into a standalone book. 8 years before I started working there, he had been, I guess, mulling it over for 8 years. And that day, my, you know, second full day at work, my third actual day, he decided to call my boss and say he wanted to do it. Basically, he wanted to do a little research before deciding that he wanted to do it. So we then heard from him all the time. I honestly don't know. This is pure speculation. But he was always really in a great mood and really jovial. And my boss was a little bit invigorated by the process of publishing this story, even though she sort of said, this is crazy. Why would we do this? And it was crazy. And yet the strangeness of it and the prospect of a new Salinger book, I think, excited her. And maybe it excited him, too. So he really did call about every tiny detail. You know, we need to work out the spine of the book. We need to talk about the binding. He would call all the time. He would sometimes call just to talk, not necessarily gossip, but just to kind of talk about the publisher, to get my take on things with the publisher.
So you, even though you had orders not to talk to him, ended up talking to him.
That's right. I did. I was always very nervous. I'm a very rule-following person. I would try at first. He would ask me questions, you know, so, you know, how's your day? How are you doing? And that kind of thing. And I would just basically not answer because I was afraid of my boss coming out and finding me talking to him. But eventually, you know, I succumbed a little bit and I did definitely get to talk to him or allow myself to talk to him. Sometimes he made it impossible. I couldn't just be rude to him. You know, he would ask me questions about my life or about this new book or the publisher or ask my opinion on things. And I just didn't have it in me to sort of hang up on him or just put him through to my boss without another word. It just seemed like I would seem crazy to do
right.
that.
And also, it wasn't that he wasn't interested in you or just that being myopic and this is the person I want to talk to and anybody else I don't want to talk to.
Exactly. I think my boss, you know, might have been, I don't want to say she was wrong because that's not actually true. I think she was nervous that she'd had assistants. There had been assistants who had abused their position there.
Right.
And so she felt that she had to really, really strictly warn me. And maybe I being, you know, the classic sort of obedient child took that warning, you know, to the letter more so than maybe someone who was more rebellious or more confident or something like that.
And then you finally got to meet him.
I did. Yes. Very unexpectedly. Here again, because of security, they did not tell anyone that he was coming in because I think there was fear that not necessarily me, but another assistant or someone might notify a friend or might do something or who knows what. But suddenly he just appeared. Mm-hmm. And he's a pretty distinctive looking person. And from my desk, I could kind of see a big swath of the office. I was tucked away in this kind of dark alcove sort of area, but I could see this other part of the office where all the finance people sat. And I saw this man kind of loping across it, this very, very, very tall man with enormous ears who looked like Salinger in the photos of him that you see from the 50s and early 60s, but, you know, with white hair and a lined face. He looked a little bit like Samuel Beckett in a way. And I thought, that can't be him. That's just not possible. But then, of course, it was.
The part of the story which is so fascinating is that you get all of the letters and then you have a script, but you make, again, the conscious decision to go off script, to start to write to these people. Did you still want to in some way follow the company line? Or, in other words, did you just want to update the letter and be a little bit nicer about it? Or did you really want to engage the people?
That's a good question. At first, I think it was both. At first, I just wanted to update the letter because, so I was 23 years old. I was extremely earnest, you know, sort of believed in kind of the religion of literature, but also being 23, I had been in this kind of coddled universe of my, you know, my home, my parents, and then at Oberlin where, you know, I was told that my opinion mattered. So incredibly much, and then in grad school, and suddenly I was in this kind of office setting where I really didn't matter. I was signing my name to the letters, but I was just a kind of vessel for the letters. However, I had that 23-year-old's ridiculous zeal and earnestness, and I thought, I can't sign my name to this letter. I would never write this. You know, this is ridiculous. And so I really did want to update it just to seem a little more gentle, in part because some of these letters were really heartbreaking. You know, they were tales of death, destruction, a lot of people who had lost children, you know, because Salinger's work deals a lot with the death of children or even grown children,
right.
Like losing children once they're grown, like Seymour Glass kills himself. A lot of stuff about suicide, also a lot of stuff about the war. Salinger, of course, you know, went through some pretty terrible stuff when he served during World War II. And you had a lot of veterans writing in, talking about their own experiences and how Salinger helped them through. And then finally, there were also a lot of teenagers who were writing about feeling alienated, how no one understood them, as well as Salinger, how they were like Holden or they were in love with Holden. So all of these camps of people, it felt hard to just send back this letter that essentially was saying, you know, you're an idiot forever even thinking that this your letter would be passed on to Salinger. Please just go back in your hole and never contact us again. It just was hard. So I partly wanted to update it just so that it seemed a little softer and a little more gentle. But then there were some letters that were just so kind of, this is a word I never use, but I'm just going to whip it out now. They were kind of juicy. They had so much in them. Like some of the letters were really well written. They were huge, long letters. They were short stories in and of themselves. And I just couldn't resist engaging with some of them, especially some of the younger people who were seeking advice from Salinger. I was also maybe a little bit underemployed. The agency was not necessarily thriving. My boss didn't have a lot of living clients, so I didn't have that much to do, you know, and I wanted to be a writer myself. So somehow I took all these aspects of my job. There were other ones other than answering Salinger's fan mail. I took them a little bit too seriously. So that might have been it, that I was able to become absorbed in these people's lives, like in a Miss Lonely Heart sort of way, because I didn't have that much to do. So I would sit there and read them over and over again and obsess over how to respond to them and think, what would Salinger say to this person? You know?
Even though you were still signing your name.
Yes, I was signing my name, but somehow with certain letters, I took it upon myself to write real thought-out responses to people, trying to figure out what Salinger would say to them if he had indeed received the letter.
It is fascinating. You mentioned this, and it's something you talk about, and I was interested in there's got to be a club of all of you who have held that job, and it must be fascinating talking to them about what went on.
It is. And so I sometimes think there should be an official club. Because when I worked there, the person who had held my job before me, who had it for a year or two, and my boss had absolutely loved him. She honestly tended to get along a little better with men. She had an unusually large number of male assistants, which are not that common in publishing. But somehow that was kind of her ethos. She was kind of a woman from the 50s and 60s who had never married and didn't really have time for the kind of frippery of girlhood and that kind of thing. She wore sensible pantsuits and orthopedic shoes. Anyway, so I would have to talk to him on the phone to ask him questions because nothing was computerized and the agency was so old-fashioned that a lot of the information would be kept in people's heads. So sometimes I just couldn't find it. And she would say, well, call Jay. And I would call him up at his new job. He worked for a scout at the time. And we would he would say, oh, you know, she's up to her old antics. And we would have these really cathartic conversations. But most of it. And anyway, after that, I was contacted by the person who had the job after me, and I still am in touch with him a bit. And just recently, I was interviewed for the New York Observer by a reporter who had held my job just a few years ago. Mm. And so anyway, when I have these conversations with people, what always ends up happening is that we don't really talk about Salinger. We talk more about how kooky the office was and its archaicness. So there's a lot of talk about, you know, my boss chain smoking, all day, walking in, carrying a cigarette, smoking until the end of the day, that kind of thing. The dictaphone, you know, the lack of computers, the ancient receptionist who's sort of, you know, not quite up to par, the ancient messenger. They had this messenger who appeared to be 85 years old, and he was a little bit like something out of The Hobbit. And he was the least qualified person to be a messenger. I felt like, are they just throwing money down a hole and keeping this man on the salary? Because he would go out carrying one manuscript and kind of hobble out, come back hours later and get another one. You thought, they could use FedEx for every single manuscript, and it would cost less than this guy's salary. And so anyway, we would talk about this. The ways in which the agency kind of clung to these routines, because they were part of their culture and because this was the way the agency did things, even though the world had really changed so dramatically. I mean, even in 1996. So just a few years ago, they were kind of operating in a pretty similar way, I found out. And, you know, they seemed to sort of be more interested in being the agency and doing things the agency way than they were interested in kind of making money and selling books in the way that contemporary agencies, more recently formed agencies, are.
So with the death of Salinger, did that radically change things? Did that increase, from your knowledge, did it increase the amount of work at the agency, or did it just fall off?
I honestly don't know. I don't think it increased the work. I really don't. From what I know from this person who worked there recently, I don't know how much it changed things. I mean, I think now they don't have Jerry calling and saying, can I see these royalty statements from whatever year, or just asking questions. And then the whole what would happen is that he would call and then the whole agency would snap into action as if suddenly someone had pressed the fast forward button.
Mm.
And so you don't have that dynamic anymore of Salinger, you know, calling and everyone kind of freaking out a little bit. But I don't know how much has changed because, I mean, things could have, he could have changed, things could have changed in the years since I worked there. But I think the normal status was that he just didn't call that much. So I don't know.
Here's my impression from reading the book, and that is it's a beautiful memoir because it, as you say, you explain this, the style is beautiful. There is a breeziness to it that is lovely, but there is also, you seem to be very affectionate throughout it. It is what it is, and you seem to even though there are some very odd situations, that there is affection and even more than that, perhaps, in the experience, which leads me to the question, A, is that how you feel? And B, do you think that you could have possibly written that at 23 or 24, or does that come with time and age of looking back on a situation?
Yeah, I'm so glad to hear that it reads that way to you, because that's the absolute truth. I don't know if you've read any of the coverage of the book, but certain media outlets have compared it to The Devil Wears Prada.
Yeah.
And I don't know if they're talking about the book or the movie, but I was really surprised. I mean, I understand the kind of boss-assistant dynamic, of course, yes.
Right.
But my boss was not a mean, dictatorial person who was kind of playing with me and trying to teach me lessons.
But an eccentric and a character.
Exactly. She was an eccentric. She was a big personality. She was a real character. And she was also simply someone from a different era.
Yeah.
And one thing that I should explain is that my parents had me very late in life. So I have a sister who's 18 years older than I am, whose kids are closer in age to me than I am to her. And my boss was about the same age as my mom. And they actually shared the same first name, which I won't say on the air. I think that I got along very well with my boss and had a lot of patience for her because I understood where she was coming from culturally, because my mother had a lot of the same values, sort of cultural values, material values, social values, just outlook on life. They were from a very similar background. All this is to say that I felt a lot of affection for her. She taught me a lot about life, even by sort of showing me how publishing used to be and how how not to work in publishing. Just that taught me a lot about the world, about every aspect of the world and of how I wanted to be in the world. I loved the job. I think it might be clear. I really did love the job. All around me, the world was changing. So my closest friend from high school worked in the McGraw-Hill building, just a few blocks away, you know, 5-minute walk, these huge glass towers and this big bullpen office with light streaming in, but in like a foam board cubicle. It was a paperless office. She was working on textbooks and, you know, no literary value. She, like me, had been a poet. She was much more successful and I think much more talented than was I. And my office was the opposite of that. We didn't have any overhead lights. It was, you know, beautifully carpeted with sort of oriental rugs and floor-to-ceiling bookcases filled with classic works of literature. And it had a very different value system. It wasn't, I mean, part of what that agency was saying to the world was, we're not just about money. Like, we're partly about money because we're an agency, but we're not just about money. We're about a value system and a culture. Which is what publishing, in a way, used to be. And things were kind of changing over to a more corporate model. Some large independent publishers were being enfolded into bigger corporate entities. There were just a lot of changes happening at that time. Everything was becoming a conglomerate. And they were this kind of last man standing in this world that was changing around them. It was kind of like, I think about, there's a children's book in which these that my daughter loves, in which there's this little pink Victorian house that's basically in the middle of what looks like, I don't know, New York City or something. It's surrounded by big buildings. And that's sort of how I picture the agency in a way.
for me coming in reading the book about you and about this agency that represents J.D. Salinger, there's a part that it seems that that's sort of the way you want it.
Yeah, that you want Salinger's agency to have the old lamps and the leather chairs. Yeah.
You don't want it to be some corporate structure of cubicles and bright lights.
No. And there's also the kind of inverse, if that's the right term. I don't know if it is. But which is that I began to wonder as I worked there, to what extent was the agency frozen in this moment, this kind of 1950s moment, because Salinger was their most well-known client, their iconic client. Mm. Had they frozen themselves in this moment when he was so famous that he was on the cover of Time magazine? How were those two phenomenon linked? Had they frozen themselves in this moment and refused computers because Salinger himself was not necessarily frozen in this moment? Salinger loved TV. He had a computer. He used the internet. But he did really prize typewriting, did really seem to be kind of immersed in a more analog world.
When you would talk to him on the phone and you would get off and then leave work for the night and you were out with your friends, is it like jury duty that you don't talk about it at all? Did you have the discipline to not say a word?
So you were really not supposed to say anything.
Yeah.
The big fear was really simply that you would, I don't know, steal the Rolodex card with his information on it and give it to someone or something like that. I don't know that they cared that much about whatever tiny bit of information you would impart, but it was pretty clear that you just weren't supposed to be yammering about Salinger all the time. I was able to not talk so much about him. In fact, there's a character in the book who's referred to as Don, who was my boyfriend, and I lived with him.
Right.
And so there was this deal going on, this deal to republish Hapworth, or publish Hapworth as a book. It was under such a code of silence that, so I lived with him. I didn't even tell him about it, not one word during that whole time that I worked there. And I interviewed him when I was working on the book, and I said, do you remember this? Because he was asking me sort of about the plot arc of the book. And I said, do you remember this whole thing? And he said, no, I have no idea what you're talking about. You never mentioned that. So I was pretty able to, but it was less a matter of discipline and more a matter of kind of cult-like inculcation that I was so affected by the agency's values and code of secrecy that it didn't even occur to me to talk about Salinger. I talked about his fans. I would tell people about the letters, but I never said anything about Salinger himself.
Because it's a hell of an icebreaker.
I know. Well, you know, there in the original draft of the novel, actually, the memoir, there were a couple of scenes actually in which Don would use it as an icebreaker. We went to tons of parties, and he would often say, you know, guess where Joanna works? Guess who the most famous client at Joanna's agency is? And it honestly, this is the scene in the book, the big scene in which this happens. It happened maybe two or three times, and I took them all out. But it happened constantly. And I honestly eventually got upset with him and said, you know, I'm not a show pony. I'm not, you know, a cocktail party conversation. I started to feel such allegiance to the agency, but also allegiance to the fans that I felt like, come on, don't, because he would bring up the kind of goofiness of the fan letters and kind of make fun of them. And when I first started there, I could sort of join in with him. But by the time, I don't know, I was 7-8 months into the job, my allegiance was with them rather than him. And I thought, give them a break here. These are earnest, wonderful letters. Leave them alone. I felt very uncomfortable.
The name of the new memoir is My Salinger Year. It is published by Knopf. Joanna Rakoff, what a great pleasure. Thank you so much
joining
us. A delight. Thank you.
Joanna Rakoff's new memoir is My Salinger Year. It is published by Knopf. We enjoy hearing from our listeners about the show. You can email us at book@wamc.org. You can listen again to this or find past book shows at wamc.org. Sarah LeDuc produces our program. Bookmark us for next week. And thanks for listening. For The Book Show, I'm Joe Donahue.